You are tuned into Radio Alhara. I'm Stefan Christophe in Montreal. This is my monthly artist interview contribution to this station in Palestine, Radio Alhara. I speak with an artist each month. It is Friday, the 4th of March. And on the broadcast today, I'm going to be sharing an interview that I did with singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn. You might know Bruce Cockburn from songs like Lovers in a Dangerous Time. Also, his other song that really is a focus of this interview, which is If I Had a Rocket Launcher. Bruce Cockburn has been a steadfast presence in folk and singer-songwriter networks within North America for many years, decades. And I've always appreciated his work, and particularly thought about his song, If I Had a Rocket Launcher, many times in the context of thinking about what it means to resist injustice. It's really a song that developed within the context of a visit that Cockburn took with some activists from Toronto to a frontline community on the border of Mexico and Guatemala in the context of the Cold War, when the U.S. administration was arming the right-wing paramilitaries in Guatemala, who were eventually found guilty of carrying out genocidal actions against the Mayan indigenous communities. Cockburn visited and witnessed the situation, took in stories, and also saw the military hardware of the Guatemalan army just on the border, particularly helicopter flybys, some which attacked the refugee camps just inside of the border of Mexico. The song came out of that context, and I thought it would be really important to talk to Bruce Cockburn about that song for Radio Hara in Palestine, because I think often when we discuss the frameworks of violence and frameworks of understanding anti-colonial struggles, struggles against injustice, you know, in the context of Guatemala, of course, we can really think about the fact that the U.S. Army and military industrial complex backed the right-wing government of Guatemala in the context of the Cold War. And there was many groups, armed groups opposing that right-wing government that was involved through paramilitaries in carrying out massacres against indigenous communities. And I think Cockburn's song asked the question, if I had a rocket launcher, what would you do? And, you know, when we think about Palestine and the armed resistance to Israeli injustice and occupation, that framework of understanding, of thinking about the ways that a context of injustice can really inspire and push people to act, you know, in very extreme circumstances of colonial manifestations of violence to take up arms. And this is, you know, coming from a singer-songwriter who's beloved in, you know, Canada, who wrote this song. So I wanted to have a conversation with him about it for Radio Hara in Palestine. So here's my conversation with Bruce Cockburn.
People in churches saying, look, saying the same thing I'm saying, that we got to get along, we got to figure this out. But they're up against, we are all up against this other phenomenon, which, you know, as I tend to define things in spiritual terms a lot for myself. And to me, when I, the first glimpse I had of Donald Trump, when I realized, actually not of him, but of his supporters, when I realized like 6 months before the election that he was going to win it, I thought this is satanic. This is like, this is so wrong. This guy is the worst possible presence in that kind of position. And he didn't let me down, what he set loose is like, you know, is all this fractiousness I mean, it was already there, but in earlier eras, it's not just Trump, it's the internet. It's and the way people use it. It's not the internet either. It's just, it is how it gets used. And all of this stuff kind of conspiring, you know, the panic that no one really talks about about climate change. They either deny it in a panic or they embrace it in a panic, but none of them acknowledge the panic part. And so, you know, we've got that going. We've got the threat to global democracy. It's not just in the US and Canada, but it's pretty global. There's all these things, and all of those things are conspiring to take us down, in effect. So, you know, it has to be resisted. And the only way I can see to resist it is with I don't know how you translate this into, you know, actual like day-to-day terms, but it's with love. You've got to put that out there and spread it around as much as you can, and see where you can take it. Because, you know, obviously voting counts, and the mechanics of politics count hugely, but they are mechanics and they're not the spirit of the thing. And what has to be addressed is that spirit of darkness that's settling over everything. You can see it in psychological terms. And I've said this, you know, in other contexts earlier on, but it has seemed to me for a couple of decades now that there's a war within humanity, within the collective psyche, kind of between Thanatos, the desire to be dead, and the urge to live, that we often express as love, and those things are they can coexist and do in a balanced person, but when it becomes a collective thing, it becomes more easier to tip the balance in one way or the other. Well, in the wrong way, I guess. It's not easy to tip it in the right way for some reason, but so the urge to self-destruct, like we've got that, and we have to fight that in ourselves and as a collective entity.
There's a lot of love that you put into your work in terms of your work as a musician and the amount of hours that you spend on your craft and the preparations that you're working on to share that craft publicly. I would imagine there's a lot of dedication both for yourself, but also to continue to share your work in the public space. How does love factor into that individual drive to persistently hone your craft, to create and to like take the time? Because things like your work don't happen quickly, right? And I think often people have this conception that, you know, a song comes into somebody's mind, and sometimes it does, or a lyric, but there's a whole context and process that is so invisibilized by the Western narrative of, like, you know, an artist just coming out of nowhere. But the love of the craft, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, for me, it was a long, slow development. Some people have an easier time of it than I did, I think, of understanding that aspect of things. I when I was a teenager, I wanted to play guitar. I didn't really want to do anything else. I mean, I liked reading and I liked hanging out and whatever else. But I mean, you know, I've never owned up to having an ambition. But I wanted to spend time with the guitar and did. And, you know, okay, so when it comes time to go to college, my parents are going, you got to go to college. I'm going, I don't want to go to college. I just want to go and play music. And, you know, you got to go to college. Okay, well, how about music school? Okay, you can go to music school. So I went to music school. And I dropped out after a while because I realized that the direction I had thought I wanted to study in was not a direction, which was composing music for large jazz ensembles or whatever. I wasn't well suited to that, and it wasn't really in my heart when I started digging into it. I didn't know what was there, so I dropped out, joined a band, and I kind of wandered around for a half a decade in and out of different bands, learning to write songs without really thinking of it as a learning process, just writing for the bands I was in. But over the over that second half of the 60s, it was like, okay, you know, this is what you're doing. And I started realizing that I could do it, for one thing, and that I really liked doing it. And that, I mean, I liked the process of sitting, writing a song, of coming up with words and then finding music for those words. And I haven't lost my love for that. It's my favorite thing to do. It doesn't happen all that often, or at least, well, it happens often enough, but not with the frequency that would be more satisfying, but because there's large gaps, you know, where I don't write anything and don't have any ideas, and then some stuff will come, and you know, so, but that's been the pattern for, you know, the last 50 years or plus. And it comes over the years. What I learned was, at first, I learned that I actually do love it. You know, I couldn't define love to myself, or because I grew up in a family that never used the word. So, you know, it's like, what does that mean? I don't know what it means. But over the years, I discovered what it meant. And one of the things, the first clue was, I discovered I actually love my audience. Once somebody pointed out to me that I should pretend I did, it's like, what? Oh, you mean you're supposed to love these people? But I thought I was just scared of them, you know. But I still got up and did it because I wanted to play the songs. But then once I started pretending I loved them, I discovered that I actually did, and that you get this flow back and forth. And so, you know, that's part of the picture too. I mean, when I write these songs, I'm writing them for in the expectation that people I love are going to hear them.
Right on. Respect. Well, one song that I love is If I Had a Rocket Launcher. I've listened to that song countless times, especially as an activist. I really appreciated the context within which it was written. And it's gotten quite a lot of shares recently. But within this song, I'd love to hear a bit about it, but within the song, one of the lyrics is, I want to raise every voice, at least I've got to try. Every time I think about it, water rises to my eyes. Can you talk a bit about like how you came to share that those words? I'd like to talk a bit about the specific context of the song, but I know that you're pointing to a broader idea here about collectively raising voice.
I've talked about this song a lot, as you probably know. So, you know, some of what I'm about to say may sound a little rehearsed, but basically the song was a product of some days spent in two refugee camps in the south of Mexico, in Chiapas, very close to the Guatemalan border, in a period when there was a ferocious war of repression going on in the Guatemalan highlands primarily against the native people. Who inhabit those mountains. They are Mayan people. They live in varying degrees of sort of traditional style, but there was a revolution because of decades of abuse by racism by the people who control the country against those people. And the abuse would take the form of, you know, if somebody showed up wearing glasses, it might mean they could read, and therefore they were a threat to the powers that be, and they would be exterminated. And, you know, and not usually in a fairly brutal way. And then they started doing this to whole villages. As the rebellion started, after decades of this, people got fed up, and you got a leftist revolution that went out and became an army and fought the government. Okay, well, you know, but these people living in the villages, the government's philosophy was, which they learned to some degree from the United States, was because they employed a tactic that was used in Vietnam with about the same degree of success as it was in Guatemala, which is not much, of creating strategic hamlets. So they forced people to move off their traditional land and into areas that could be easily controlled and monitored. And people didn't want to move. In the Mayan culture, they bury their they bury their umbilical cord where they're born, and they don't want to leave that spot. That's part of their understanding of how the cosmos works. And so, among other things, that was an impediment. So the military responded to that kind of resistance by going in and exterminating villages. The classic, the same old, the mundane, the banality of this is as disturbing as the horror of it in a way, but it's the same old stuff. The people get herded into the church, they set the church on fire, and then shoot anybody who tries to run out. And so all these people are burned up in the church. Or they grab all the babies and throw them down the well. It's hideous stuff and much worse than what I've just described. And I'm hearing stories from these refugees about these things that they've witnessed and experienced and fled from. And at the same time, we're sitting there in the jungle, they have nothing. In one of the two camps, they were living on a ration of, there was like 3,000 people in that camp, living on a ration of 3 tortillas a day. That's all they had. And no expectation of getting anything else because the Mexican government wasn't supporting them, that wouldn't let the UN in. And the church was doing, the Archbishop of San Cristobal, he was the archbishop that was based in San Cristobal Las Casas down in Chiapas. And he was providing whatever support he could kind of clandestinely do because he had to be careful. The government didn't want, for some reason, I don't know why, they didn't want to acknowledge that there was a refugee issue. They had 100,000 refugees, but they didn't want to own up to it. So they didn't want anybody to go in there. We had to sneak into these camps, which wasn't very hard to do, but it had to be clandestine. And the church was trying to support this stuff, but it was minimal. But here they are in these deprived conditions, having fled this horrible stuff that they fled. And in the one camp that was quite close to the border, you hear the sound of it? Like in the morning, the helicopter goes by. You don't see it, but it's patrolling the border. A couple hours later, it comes back the other way. And then, this happens all day. And maybe they're different helicopters, maybe it's the same one. But the week before I was there, they had flown up over the camps and strafed them from the air. And this is on Mexican territory, and probably one of the reasons the Mexican government was hesitant to make a big deal out of this was they didn't want a confrontation with Guatemala for whatever reason. I mean, they could have easily stomped them because there's way more Mexicans than there are Guatemalans, but whatever. This was going on. So I hear, and I'm thinking, I just started feeling a sense of outrage, out of which came the song. So I got out of the, after we left the camps, we're sitting in this little town in a hotel, and I started, I went out and I bought a bottle of something, I don't remember what, and whiskey, I think, and I'm sitting there drinking whiskey and in tears, actually, because of all this, and started writing the song. And I thought, I wrote it right from the gut, from the heart. It's how I felt. After I wrote it, I thought, I can't sing this for anybody. I don't want to encourage people to go kill Guatemalan soldiers, and that's how people will hear it. So I didn't, I almost didn't record it because of that, because I didn't want it to be misunderstood. And I bored a lot of audiences. The first couple of years I was touring with that song, because I would launch into a long speech similar to what you've just heard about the origins of it. And, it was too much talk for a concert, but people mostly put up with it, but I really didn't want it to be misunderstood. People misunderstand things anyway. I had a guy come up, I've told this story too, but a guy come up to me on the street in Toronto when the video of Rocket Launcher was on Much Music a lot. He said, "Oh, I like that Rocket Launcher song." He said that, and I've seen the video, man. He said, "Things must be terrible there in Africa." okay. You know, I didn't bother correcting him. It's like, I'm not going there. I've got other things to do with my time. But you know, I mean, the guy was being nice. He was, and he was genuinely touched by the song, but he wasn't paying attention and he had no knowledge of the context. And so what he heard in it, what he liked about it, was the expression of outrage. And that unfettered, I guess, it strikes people this way, an unfettered kind of expression of that internal rage that we seem to be born with, that we spend large parts of our intentional life kind of subduing. And that, you know, that's, I think, why the song was so popular. I was taught to care about what happens to my fellow human beings, but I didn't take it as far as the direct political involvement until the mid-70s, when I started meeting Aboriginal people and coming to understand what kind of lives had been inflicted on them and on my peers, basically, the people the same age, others, singer-songwriters, Shingus, Tom Jackson. I met these guys out west, and I think, holy jeez, like, my life wasn't anything like that. So, you know, and why is that? So, you know, you look at these things. And that was the start of it. And then Central America kind of pushed it further.
You mentioned your collaboration with Indigenous artists, both on the album artwork. I know that you collaborated with some Indigenous artists on the cover art for some of your albums, and also for the imagery and the relationships you talked about. Why was this important for you, and how is it related also to the experiences that you had in Central America?
Central America particularly was related in the context of Guatemala and the other countries in the region too, but primarily Guatemala. The main victims, the largest proportion of victims of that war were Indigenous people. And of course, that's a continuation in what is on our, unfortunately, traditional terms of what used to be done here. And the end result was similar. You end up with an apartheid system that, or the model, the actual model for apartheid, and a failure to understand that that Indigenous people were actually human beings, and that they should be, you know, the notion that they should be treated in some interim, some way between kind of farm animals and people. They were somewhere in between there. And so, you know, just that we look at that, and it's disgusting to think that anybody thought that way, but it was the prevailing attitude among, you know, among European settlers. So, and it's still, I mean, in the 70s, when I first started traveling out west, it was real easy to find that attitude among the white population of, you know, Saskatchewan and Alberta. Well, Alberta, I mean, it didn't just extend to Native people. I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, I read a newspaper article from the early 1900s from Edmonton, which made a distinction between white people and Ukrainians. You know, it was like, because there were all these Ukrainian immigrants coming in and at the behest of the Canadian government, but, you know, in the Alberta context, they weren't considered white people. What the fuck is that? Like, you know, I mean, but this is what we grew out of, okay? And thank God we've grown out of it for the most part. Everybody benefits, but there's still room to keep that process going.
That was a conversation with Bruce Coburn, singer-songwriter. I would encourage you to visit and learn more about his work. I'm Stefan Christoph in Montreal. This is my monthly artist interview series on Radio Hara. Once a month, I feature a 30-minute interview here on the station, and it's my pleasure to do so. So I'll be back in April with another interview. And in the meantime, free Palestine, and I'll talk to you soon.
Here comes the helicopter. Second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
Thank you. listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference.